The top stories from the KCBS Radio Newsroom. This is the All Local.
At least three people are dead at a law enforcement training facility in Los Angeles. To bring us the latest, we're joined live on the KCBS Ring Central Newsline by reporter Steve Gregory, who covers law enforcement for Odyssey News Station KNX in Los Angeles. Steve, thanks for the time.
Of course, Holly. Good morning.
So what do we know? Because we've heard everything from a training exercise to maybe moving munitions.
Yeah, so around 7:30 this morning is when the explosion was first heard. And from what we're told, it was ordnance. And this could be, you know, explosives used in military or construction or ammunition of some kind. And it was in a specially secure truck. And I'm told that these technicians, these bomb technicians, were moving that ordnance when the explosion happened. It's unclear whether it was related to a training exercise, but early reports would indicate that they were simply moving it from one spot to another when it happened. And the facility is where they store their large Bearcat trucks, those big armored vehicles that you might see at crime scenes. And this is also where the bomb squad, the SWAT team, and the Special Enforcement Bureau works out of. This is their headquarters for the Sheriff's Department. So it's primarily an industrial area where most of L.A. County's motor fleet is. This is where a lot of the big trucks are stored. And just right up the hill from the facility is where the L.A. County Fire Department's headquarters is also. So this is an area where it's known for a lot of industrial and law enforcement training.
So they're used to having this kind of material on site.
Absolutely. And here's the thing, you know, as you know, these bomb technicians are among the most highly trained, specialized individuals in law enforcement. They do everything by the book because they can't afford to make mistakes. There's no second guessing. It's all by the book. It's all based on science. It's all very, very meticulous work. So that's why this is extremely shocking today, because this is usually something that these bomb techs are used to handling on a regular basis. And so that's why the FBI has sent in its arson and explosives unit. They're on scene now. In fact, they're trying to clear the scene to make sure there's no other danger. But we are told three dead and possibly a fourth individual transported to a hospital.
Yeah, I was going to ask you if there were any other injuries at that hour at that facility. If other people would be around, is it busy, not so busy?
Yeah, so at that time of the day, in 7:30 in the morning, it's very active because that's also the academy where a lot of recruits start their training. There are a lot of classrooms that are right adjacent to this Special Enforcement Bureau parking lot and the classrooms. And ironically enough, Holly, this is also the location of the L.A. County Law Enforcement Memorial. There is just, I'm just telling you, a few dozen yards away from when this explosion happened is a wall filled with plaques honoring law enforcement individuals who have lost their life in the line of duty. So this is a very important facility, and it's been there for many decades. And it's, I'm telling you, a department that has been reeling from a series of deaths over the last couple of years. It's a really, really a sad day for the LA County Sheriff's Department.
One last thing. How long do they keep these ordinances? Because do they tend to degrade the longer they're around, the longer they're stored?
Well, and great question. And it typically depends on the age of the ordinance when they receive it. So if it's already something that's been out there and it could be unstable, it also has to do with the chemical makeup of the ordinance. What kind of explosive material was it? Was it being properly stored? And in this particular case, again, it was in a specially secure vehicle, and presumably it was being handled by the experts themselves who know how to handle this equipment. And we don't know whether they thought these were training or inert ordinances or whether these were actual ordinances seized in an operation. Those are details we're hoping will be clarified in an upcoming press conference.
Steve, thanks so much for the perspective. Appreciate it. I know you're a busy guy down there. Again, Steve Gregory, reporter with Odyssey News Station KNX in Los Angeles, covering law enforcement. A group of indigenous youth have become the first in over a century to paddle the restored Klamath River from its source to the sea. That was 300 miles, and it follows the largest dam removal project in the world. For more, we're joined live on the KCBS Ring Central Newsline by Weston Boyles, founder of and executive director of Rios to Rivers USA. Weston, thanks for the time.
Hello. Thank you so much for having us on.
Yeah. Now, I remember when they said they were going to start to do this. They finished the paddle, right?
Yeah, we finished last Friday. It was really, really beautiful day and very exciting for the students to complete the journey.
Talk about, you know, what kind of experiences this was for the kids.
Yeah, so this was 4 years in the making. Some of these students have been training in kayak skills for 4 years to be able to have the skills necessary to be able to make the descent. And so this is a culmination of a lot of hard work. The Klamath River now mostly flows freely. There's many big technical rapids on the river that are newly freed, now, you know, part of the river. And the kids had to prepare quite a bit to get ready for that.
This is the return of the river, the return of salmon. What do you want people to know about these endangered river basins?
Yeah. Science is showing us more and more that free-flowing rivers are critical to supporting a river's ability to help absorb carbon from the atmosphere, and then as well as all the host of things that rivers do for providing salmon, fish habitat, and then recreational opportunities. So really free-flowing rivers are a much better alternative than hydroelectric dams. And there's other ways to produce energy, such as solar and wind, that can replace the energy that was produced by dams.
This feels like a real environmental win, which isn't something you see very often these days.
Yeah, it's a moment, really a great celebration. I think great celebration for the tribes that worked so hard within the Klamath Basin to get the dams removed and all the people that were a part of the dam removal process. And now for this next generation of youth to be a part of that celebration and find joy and access to their ancestral waterways. And really, the river was a highway for the indigenous people of the Klamath. It was a trade route for all the tribes within the basin. There was, unfortunately, due to the dams and other forces of colonialism, a disconnection with the river. And it's been an opportunity now that the river is flowing more freely for the youth to connect with the river.
Is there anywhere else where you could potentially see something similar? Any other river that has similar threats and the effort is being made to try and open it up?
Yes. So there's work on the Eel River, and that is looking positive for a dam to come off the Eel River. There's also work on the Lower Snake River to remove four dams there that would greatly open up habitat for salmon and support the orcas that are in the Salish Sea, basically making more salmon habitat and returning the ability for orcas to have a food source where they are in the Salish Sea.
Weston, well, congratulations on completing the paddle and opening up the river. Weston Boyles, founder and executive director of Rios to Rivers USA. Internet use is at an all-time high across California, but there are still widening gaps in access to high-speed connections. For more, we're joined live on the KCBS Ring Central Newsline by Joseph Hayes, senior research associate with the Public Policy Institute of California. Joseph, thanks for the time.
Thanks for having me on.
Okay, so what you saw was a record 96% of Californians with access to the internet. That is up from 92% the last time you looked. So who's being left out?
Well, that is a California average, as you mentioned. And I want to point out that the increase is substantial, 92% up to 95%. But it's slowed in recent years, for one thing. If you just look at going from 2019 to 2022, that's an increase from 92 to 95%. And just only incrementally up to 96% as of 2023, which is the latest year we have data from. But if you look at black households, Latino households, low-income households, households headed by somebody without a college degree, those numbers are lower. And that's the concern that we're trying to highlight here, is that digital equity is not really where we need it to be.
Where are those people going for internet access? Are they doing it at school for the kids? Is it at a library?
Oh, well, that's how we got into it to begin with. Obviously, when the pandemic shut down schools, and then everybody was doing school at home. And it's true that a lot of parents were trying to work from home at the same time. So, yeah, you saw a lot of news coverage of people camping out in Taco Bell parking lots or whatever to try to get Wi-Fi that way. No, that's certainly a last resort. Schools have been instrumental in providing internet access to their students, and in the case of state and federal provided funds, a lot of times the schools have been leading the charge in not just providing internet access at school, but in building capacity for their communities at large to access high-speed internet.
Those people that don't have high-speed internet, it's not like they don't want it, right? I mean, they are seeking it out. They just can't get it. I mean, you know, and how do you differentiate between, you know, need and use, and once they get it, how they use it?
Yeah, that's a good point. There's definitely a need all around for internet. The uses that we have tracked make it clear that internet access is not really a luxury as we've come to think of it, but rather a necessity. So more than 3/4 of people are using internet for, say, financial transactions, banking and investment, paying bills, sending money. 63% are accessing health records or insurance information, and that's up from 2021, up from 58% to now, like I said, 60%. Nearly half are using it to access government services, like registering to vote, renewing a driver's license, really fundamental stuff. So it really reinforces the truth that it's a necessity of modern life on a par with electricity and running water.
And so what do we, you know, as a society, try to do about it to reach that extra 5% that isn't online?
Well, there are federal programs that have provided money, especially given the pandemic, as I mentioned earlier. But a number of those have recently expired. The Affordable Connectivity Program, the Emergency Connectivity Fund, the past year or so, and those are federal programs that designated funds to provide access to underserved communities. There are still a few federal programs that are operating. The Broad Access and Deployment Program, BEAD program, is providing money for serving underserved communities. And at the state level, Senate Bill 156 back in 2021 provided $6 billion for those similar efforts. And that money goes to broadband consortia, nations, local governments, county offices of education for their particular projects. That they're the ones that identify the need and try to address it in the appropriate way.
Joseph, thanks so much for the time and for the research. Joseph Hayes is Senior Research Associate with the Public Policy Institute of California.
Subscribe to the All Local wherever you get your podcasts and stream us on your smart speaker 24/7 by saying play KCBS Radio.